It's so rare that you get dramas that are like this good with story, acting, subject matter. You can't tear your eyes off it.
When you're in it, you're really, really in it. It really is quite gripping.
Yeah, there's just something very special about it. It kind of like floors you a little bit.
You can't fault, I don't think, anyone's performance in it. I think Coleman's fantastic in it as well.
It's such a powerful film that I just think more people should see it.
I think it's a great film. I think Anthony Hopkins is amazing in it. It's a fucking hard watch though, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
It's a tough one.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Flixwatch Podcast. Today I'm joined by Hannah.
Hello.
Jen.
Hello.
Helen.
Hello.
And we're talking about The Father.
Thank you, as always, to the Mighty People for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher.
Hello, film fans. Thanks for listening today. Joining FlixWatcher, we have Jen and Hannah. If you could please say hello to our listeners and tell them a little bit more about who you are and what you do, please.
Hello, I am Jen Offord. I'm one of the co-presenters and producers of the Standard Issue podcast, which is, we like to call it, a magazine for ears. And we cover everything that interests women, which is everything. I've kind of forgotten the strap line we have there, but we only have women on the podcast, basically. Spoiler alert.
What?
And
I thought there was one man once.
Once a year we let men talk, which is International Men's Day, which is sort of the equivalent of how it works the other way around. So that's just how we roll. And I'm also the author of the fantastic football book, The Year of the Robin.
Yeah, talking about Charlton Athletic.
Yes. Well, it's actually, Kobe, it's sort of talking about the world through one specific crazy season in the history of Charlton Athletic. So there's something there for everyone, not just Charlton Athletic fans, which is just as well, because that is quite a small pool of people.
Niche.
But it must be quite a fun team to follow. I mean, being a Liverpool supporter is like a bit boring nowadays. You're just kind of there.
Kobe.
The first I heard about Charlton Athletic was when we found out that was Rodney Trotter's middle name in the Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah, that is inspired by the football team. We won the FA Cup once in 1947 and we still commemorate that win. That's a little note on the quality you can expect to see at Charlton Athletic. We actually drew 1-1 last night with Forest Green Rovers. Have you ever heard of them?
Nope.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Well, tell us a bit about the book. Why did you choose to write it? How is it? Are you enjoying promoting it? Enjoying talking about it? Was it a fun project?
Was it a fun project? It was kind of like a nice thing to write, because it's a lot of it is sort of part memoir. So it's kind of about me and my family and my brothers, who are kind of very integral in my relationship with football and sport. So it's kind of nice reflecting on, like, you know, stuff that went on in my childhood. And then also, spoiler alert, I got pregnant while I was following this season. So there's kind of stuff about that as well. And my daughter and the sort of like relationship that people do have with football through their families, I guess. So it was kind of nice and looking sort of nostalgic and, you know, thinking about the days when we used to consume football through teletext and Radio 5 Live and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, it used to go to like Rumbelows for like 5 o'clock on a Saturday to people to see the scores.
Funnily enough, Kobe, there is a very famous Charlton Athletic clip, bit of footage of one of our kind of like star players, I guess, from the late 80s, early 90s, called Carl Leeburn, whose son now plays for Charlton Athletic. And I interviewed his wife, Tracy, who's the player liaison officer for the book. And there's footage of him winning the Rumbelows Man of the Match
Award, and he's awarded a TV for Rumblers in Greenwich for being the man of the match.
That is, I mean, Rumblers is a deep cut, and then you had the story to match it.
it makes me really sad that children now won't understand a time when footballers won TVs from Rumblers as their reward for doing well at football. It was a different time.
Who are you down at the bottom of my screen?
Me?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Hannah Walker-Brown. I'm the creative director of Broccoli Productions, which is a joint venture with Sony Music Entertainment. We're a podcast production company based out of London. I've made audio docs and podcasts sort of for the last 15 years, and I'm also the author of A Delicate Game, Brain Injury, Sport and Sacrifice, which is also kind of a book about football, but not. It's the lens of corruption and, I guess, neurodegenerative disease through football. So slightly different.
You're talking about American football there primarily, aren't you?
No, I'm talking about soccer, rugby. Okay. It was grounded in the NFL, but actually this book primarily focuses on English sports.
Okay. So I've read the first few chapters. That shows my lack of reading all the way through. But first of all, Broccoli Productions, I think, is awesome. My favourite podcast to listen to at the moment is the I've listened to all of them, is the We Were Always Here. Going back through the AIDS epidemic through the eyes of people who lived through it first. And I think there seems to be like a wave of content surrounding that at the moment. And it makes my heart so sad to, you know, all the people we've missed out on. Starting from a film point of view, you had like Howard Ashman, who wrote like Little Mermaid, all the best songs in there, and some of Aladdin, some of Beauty and the Beast. And it's really good to hear these stories uncovered and made human in a way that just hasn't been done for a long time. So that podcast to me, I think it's fantastic, and recommend everyone listen to it. But I'm also a big fan of Cancelled as a little cheeky stab at some people.
That's the podcast everyone loves to hate, and we just keep making it because we kind of, I don't know, I make both of those shows. So thank you. Yeah, and Cancelled, I'm just like, oh my God, that, like, I've made so many episodes and I don't think Americans get the sarcasm of it, because we're not cancelling people. We're just talking about how absurd cancellations, but through these stories. Mm. And they think we're being really serious, so they think it's really crap. And then I'm like, oh, we should just stop making this. But for some reason, I can't. And I just keep making them. And I don't know. But thanks. Maybe it needs more love. I don't know.
Can I ask you a question about Cancelled? Sorry.
Yeah.
Of course.
Have you found anyone who's actually been cancelled yet? Who hasn't become more famous as a result of their cancellation?
Yeah, do you know what? The people, I don't know why I'm laughing, because this is, I mean, it just shows where the world's at. But the people that get cancelled are actually the people that didn't do anything wrong or were cancelled for reasons like, you know, being gay or trans or things that should never be cancelable offences. They never come back. Whereas, you know, you sort of... Kevin Spacey's, Kevin Hart's, etc. are thriving. Mm. Robin Thicke just did one on Blurred Lines, the song.
How did you?
He's having the time of his life. So, yeah, no, if you're a good person, you probably will get cancelled. But bad people make a comeback.
Well, tell us about A Delicate Game.
Sure.
Because that ties in with the film a bit we're going to talk about. Tell us about the kind of premise and why did you write this?
Yeah, don't know. Ask myself the same question a lot. It's really hard writing a book, as Jen can probably attest to as well. So I made a 4-part audio documentary a few years ago for Audible about this subject, in particular Jeff Astle, West Bromwich Albion player, 6 caps for England, and he died very tragically. And his cause of death at the time was dementia, but once his brain was kind of reinspected, they found chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a neurodegenerative disease caused by repetitive hits to the head. I'm simplifying this right now. This is kind of a lot more complex, and I'm going to do this kind of very quick rundown. And I sort of started to hang out with his family a bit, interview his daughter and his wife, who were just incredible women who have sort of been fighting the FA for 20 years to get answers, and were promised a lot of studies, were promised a lot of support, didn't get any, and kind of led this campaign to ultimately you know, make the game safer. And that sort of opened up a can of worms for me. I then started looking into it across all sports globally. And essentially, once the kind of podcast was done and that had made an impact, and I'd seen how much of an impact that had made, I just couldn't quite leave it alone and just felt compelled to sort of do more. So the book is a collection of kind of human stories, case studies, but also giving the kind of history of this disease, the kind of, it's entangled in sort of male ego, corruption, masculinity, violence. So the psychological impact, the historical impact, and ultimately just asks how we got here and what we're going to do about it. So it's a kind of investigative and intimate piece, I'd say. I don't know. Jen's read it. Give us a review.
It's brilliant. It's a very good read. And the podcast's great as well. Just FYI, if you want to listen to that as well.
I became aware of CTE through American football. And I was all like, well, they should stop playing that game because it sounds horrific. And you see all these stories, and I guess a lot of people saw the Will Smith film, Concussion. But I didn't realise it was an issue. I mean, I used to play rugby as a kid, and now I'm like witnessing that. I was like, oh my God, and I used to be like a front row prop. Like, so I'd literally be in the ruck every day getting smashed in and out. And so I'm like wholly aware of what's kind of going on, but I didn't realize it was a concern in the game. It's a concern in football. Is that due to heavier balls then, or is it less concern now? Or
heading?
Yeah, heading. There's like, that's a common misconception about the balls, because actually they're exactly the same.
Same weight.
Are they? They weren't heavier back in the day.
Well, the leather footballs way, way back, but because they were heavier, they couldn't travel at as much speed.
Right.
So now the synthetic balls can travel much faster. Right. So the impact's essentially the same. That's okay. Kind of a sort of a
force equals mass times acceleration.
Yeah. And actually, this has been around for way longer than anyone thinks. I think it keeps being spoken about as kind of a new phenomenon, but there are papers written by doctors for the FA and PFA, like 40, 50, 60 years ago, that are pointing to this. There's like conversations that Gordon Taylor had with people recorded on letters about this. So, you know, it's a very shady, scary thing to dive into, but actually, you know, it's not new and the impact is massive. And I think at the moment, unfortunately, it's just the tip of the iceberg. But yeah, it's heading, it's repetitive hits to the head. And you know, in a match, you might not get that many headers, but it's the drills in training the ball sort of 100 times a week.
And it's the fact that you play it from a young age. That's the thing that kind of compounds the NFL, isn't it?
And it's, you know, the brain hasn't developed and you're just causing serious damage. And especially if you're kind of, you know, the big thing at the moment is if you're playing in the kind of the Premier Leagues, the kind of upper echelons, you've got access to great medical care, but also you've got time to sit out. Like you don't lose your salary if you need to kind of recover, whereas if you move down to grassroots and kids, that's not a lot of people's kind of main source of income. So if you're playing every week, Saturday, Sunday, you're getting an injury and then you're going to work, so you're not giving yourself the time to recover. And kids as well, like, they just copy whatever they see in the big leagues, you know. So that's why it has to kind of shift. It's not just about protecting the star athletes, but that trickle effect that comes down to people that just don't have the same privileges.
The weird thing is, once you start talking about like not having heading, people get weirdly defensive, and it suddenly becomes like you're taking away the game, and it's going to ruin the game. And it's like, we're talking about serious brain injury here, and you're talking about like heading a goal.
So the culture is the hardest thing. Like, untangling, as particularly male ego, I have to say, from this is harder than actually, you know, putting it to the sporting bodies. Because again, I can totally relate to it, because when England are winning, it's the only time anyone's ever nice to you on the tube in London. Like, the energy just totally shifts. Like, we'd all love that forever. But I don't think taking the Olympic games out as well would ruin
the
Olympics
then.
I remember being on a train, they were announcing who was winning over the tannoy, like, not even when the trains were. But like, the culture is the biggest thing to change. But it's that thing, like, you just don't want to believe the thing you love is bad for you, you know? And that's really hard to kind of reconcile. It's like, you know, when an actor you love is accused of like really awful things, or your favorite film suddenly becomes tainted. Like, it's not the same, because this is like other people's lives that are ultimately being damaged. But yeah, it's a really hard one to navigate, because we love football. and we feel it belongs to us, you know? So that's tricky.
And that leads to a form of dementia, which segues to the film, which we've taken a while to get to the films, but I think that you guys got two interesting books to talk about. But we're talking about today as a film from Netflix, The Father, which is your choice, Hannah. Can you tell us why you chose it? And then I'll get my stopwatch out and you have 60 seconds to explain the synopsis.
Well, why I chose it, other than being more depressed. The synopsis, are you timing me? God, I feel under immense pressure all of a sudden.
Yeah, you have 60 seconds. So tell us why you chose it first.
I chose it because, well, ultimately, because of the subject matter, it's something, obviously, I look into my research, very interested in it. Everyone loves Olivia Colman. Didn't see it when it came out, sort of missed that whole hype. I think I was finishing my book, so anything that happened there in that year, forget it. So just sort of catching up with it now.
And the timer starts for the synopsis now.
So essentially, Anthony, played by Anthony Hopkins, helpfully, is a man, I guess, gradually succumbing to dementia, feeling abandoned, losing his kind of inability to grasp the world around him, refusing any sort of help from his daughter, Anne, played by Coleman. And we kind of watch his kind of descent and, I guess, alongside the representation of neurodegenerative disease from the sufferer, I think you also get this real palpable sense of kind of the grief of losing someone while they're still alive, but in a way that isn't melodramatic, in a way that kind of is very, it's not exploitative. And I guess actually it's sort of painfully accurate without playing into stereotypes or overdoing it. The only thing I would say is I've got a slight issue with the music, but I'm sure we'll get onto that because I've only got 5 seconds left and that is it. Whoa.
It's a tough film to place a synopsis on. I'm going to turn over to Jen first to give us your lowdown on what do you think about The Father? Have you seen it before?
Yes, I have seen it before. I need to do a little disclosure now, is that the time I've seen it before is the only time I've seen it. But I do remember it. It's fine. I just didn't have time, guys.
You didn't have to do a disclosure. You could have conned your way through this. Anyway,
I know, I was going to, but then I felt guilty. I felt like I had to tell you. Anyway, so... Yeah, I know what you mean about the structure because it's not, there isn't really, it's kind of, I suppose that's the point, isn't it, right? That dementia is a kind of like never-ending sort of, well, I mean, obviously it does eventually, but it's like a kind of long descent into increasingly horrible situation for everyone involved. And I guess maybe that's why they deliberately structured it in such a way that, I don't know, I think that really comes across, doesn't it, in the way that they've done it. I think it's a great film. I think the performances in it are fantastic. I think Anthony Hopkins is amazing in it. It's a fucking hard watch though, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
It's a tough one.
I think there's films like this, I always know I like them, but I'm always like, oh, I just don't know when the time is. And the time is when people like Hannah bring it to Flick Watcher.
Yes, yeah, sorry. I mean, sorry, I was going to go Chicken Run, and then we were like, no, don't do Chicken Run. Now I feel like this is the week we should have done Chicken Run, you know,
spirit
coming together.
Yeah, we're saying this shortly after we've heard the announcement that the Queen has passed. I guess that's what you're alluding to, Hannah.
Bloody madness in the world, I guess. Yeah. But I mean, what's chickens running around building planes when we're living how we are? Anyway.
One of my favourite posts of the past few months has been from my brother. And he said, I just wish we'd lived in unprecedented times. Because every day is like unprecedented times, unprecedented, another unprecedented. Can we just like chill out for like a month, a day or week?
I quite miss the unprecedented times. That was like COVID, wasn't it?
Helen, had you seen it before?
I had. So I kind of only really knew this from obviously the Oscars moment when everyone thought Chadwick Boseman was going to win. And Anthony Hopkins won. And I was a bit like, oh, that's a bit crap. Like, you know, Anthony Hopkins has won loads of times. Like, give it someone else. And then I saw this at the cinema when it came out. I was like, oh, yeah, so he did deserve it. By far, his performance is just incredible. The way he moves through all the different stages is, it's just incredibly real. And I just found it just a really disorientating experience and really heartbreaking. And it's one of those films where not only do you kind of see the person who's experiencing dementia, but you're also kind of feeling it through the people who are experiencing the loss of the person. Like sometimes they, films tend to feel a little bit one-sided. Mm. But in this, you're getting it at all different angles. And yeah, just like acting is just like top tier. And there's just really subtle differences in kind of the direction and in the way that the set changes, which I assume is probably taken from it being the play before, but subtle changes in like paintings move and things move and it looks like people are moving in, but they could be moving out. And there's sort of shifting in characters where it could be Anne, but it could also be Catherine, or it could be someone completely different that is only there for one moment.
Is Anne 100% Olivia Colman?
I think so, from what I've read. But then there may be instances where what we're seeing through Anthony, he thinks is Anne, but is not Anne, if that makes sense.
Well, that's why I interpreted, but also, was it Olivia Williams who played the other version of Anne? And but also played the carer, but also played the nurse in the care home at the end. So that kind of shows that it's bleeding to a lot of different timelines. I thought this film was great. I loved the way it was disorientating. Just the way you touched upon the sets, like Helen. Mm. In films, you typically have wildly different sets, so you know exactly where you are. You know, okay, that's this person's house. That's the shop. That's whatever. But the his flat versus Anne's flat, I'm not too sure if there ever were distinct two different places. The decoration changed a bit, but it's ostensibly that kind of flat in that kind of London kind of house flat you're in there, isn't it? So that's where you get. The doorway was always like the same kind of dark doorway. So just those kind of subtle set designs and production designs to make us off kilter as the viewer, as well as Mark Gatiss being the first person that turns up that's potentially a suitor for Anne. But then we're not sure if he actually is, because then Rufus Sewell is Anne's husband, who's not supposed to be there because she's getting involved with a guy in Paris. And this Paris story, I love the way this different storylines keep traveling through the whole film, like the Paris, the chicken, the watch.
So much chicken.
Yeah. And it's like, it just pulls you in. I was fascinated by it. I was absolutely fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about the set as well, because like everything was the same shape, even though things moved in and out. And maybe that is, like you said, Helen, a kind of reference to the stage play, because obviously you're quite limited in what you can kind of move around and maneuver. But actually, there's also that sense of, you know, I guess from his point of view, like suffering from a disease like dementia, which is kind of relentless once it sort of comes on, but then that can be kind of drawn out. But these things keep coming back, or, you know, memories. Sometimes you're completely like compos mentis and you know who everyone is, and then all of a sudden you don't, or you're in your space and then you're not. And there's kind of constant that disorientation, not just of like the sort of internal space of the brain, but actually everything going on around you and everyone. And I think that was done really well, that kind of, even with Anne, because there would have been moments where he wouldn't have recognized her, or he would have seen someone else. Like if that, and again, even kind of it's Imogen Poots, isn't it, playing Laura, the carer, but then also Laura's the daughter. And I thought that moment with them in the tap dancing, when suddenly he turns, it's like you're constantly in that, you're like sort of on eggshells in that adrenaline space where you don't know what might happen next. And for every kind of good minute, there could be a bad 10 coming straight after. And it can be really violent. I don't mean sort of he's violent, but that kind of leaves you with whiplash. And I think you saw that in Olivia Colman, when in that scene in particular, when she's really trying not to cry, and you know that where her mouth is going. And I feel like we've all had that situation where you're trying to keep up an appearance, but you're going, and it's really difficult. And I just think it's that constant, like you're always on an edge, I think, with something like that. And actually, by having it all in the same space, it did feel like it was sort of getting smaller and smaller, which I imagine is probably kind of how everyone feels in that situation. It almost felt like having Paris as a thing was like her escape, or even like whether that is like an actual escape or whether that was just sort of, you know, to be somewhere else other than in that situation. I don't know, maybe I'm going too deep into it. It's quite conceptual, but I just felt the way I felt watching it was the way I felt when I've interviewed people who have gone through that.
I think it's inviting you to think conceptually and deep into it. So I don't apologize for doing so. I'm still kind of flabbergasted by what I've seen and what Had anyone seen Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is the counterpoint? Helen, do you just assume that it was going to be Chadwick Boseman based on that performance of Ma Rainey's, or was it purely because he passed away and it was a good performance?
Yeah, because he'd passed away, and the way they restructured it, and like I was reading about it, and apparently, basically, Anthony Hopkins thought that that Chadwick Boseman was going to win, so he didn't bother staying awake, and the producers thought that was going to happen, so that's why they all kind of like shifted it, and then obviously it was announced, and I mean, his performance, Chadwick Boseman's performance is great. I don't think Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is that great a film, but yeah, it was just that. And it's kind of weird because all of that kind of happening, I kind of like undersells like this performance being like one of the greatest performances on screen. Like I find Anthony Hopkins can be a little bit hammy sometimes. And I'm not like, oh, he's so great, he's amazing. I'm like, yeah, sometimes he's good, sometimes he's a bit hammy.
Oh, yeah.
But this, it moved me in ways that a lot of performances haven't or haven't done recently. And yeah, there's just something very, very special about it. And it just kind of moves through different stages. And just as you're kind of sort of maybe getting used to one part, you're just like, he's gone there. And it kind of like floors you a little bit, the performance, I think.
It is incredible. It's really, it's so tragic.
I mean, he's 83 as well.
Yeah.
Sharp as a button.
It's really tragic to watch, and I think like it's very upsetting, isn't it? It's like it's not just it's like actively quite distressing to watch.
Yeah,
but I always have this thing with him. I don't know if you remember, there was a program in the 90s called Good Morning with Richard Not Judy.
Yeah, yeah, Richard Herring and Lee.
Stuart Lee and Richard Stuart Herring, Lee, yeah. And they used to do this sketch where Anthony Hopkins would like enter into correspondence with like another one of his leading ladies, so Deborah Winger or someone like that, and he'd be corresponding with them about, it'd show them like writing letters to each other basically, and he'd be writing letters to them about something really dull like butchers in 17th century England or something. I've made that up, that's not an actual example, but and then they'd start talking about that, and then he would like suddenly pivot into this like quite sexually aggressive tone, and then at the end he would always sign off, P.S. I am wanking as I write this. And
I remember that line now. I couldn't remember.
That's so terrible. Weird. Yeah.
and I can't watch him without thinking about that sketch in
That'll really put a different edge on this film, I think.
Yeah. It's... I mean, I didn't think about it so much watching this film because I was too busy crying. But but yeah, it's just, I don't really know what to say what hasn't been said already. It's a really, really brutal and devastating watch, and I'm sort of fortunate enough not to have known anyone who has suffered from dementia yet in my lifetime, but the most harrowing thing, and like you say, very disorientating, and you know, that sense of unease and uncertainty about what's going to happen, and the volatility of it, I guess, which is something that I personally find really difficult as well in other people, like the volatile people. I mean, no one really likes volatile people, do they? But it's something that I've sort of really struggle with. So yeah, I did find it a difficult watch, but you can't fault, I don't think, anyone's performance in it. I think Coleman's fantastic in it as well.
Yeah, totally. All of them, every single one.
So we've had, this is our fourth Anthony Hopkins film in the Flixwatch studios. We've had The Two Popes, Silence of the Lambs, and The Edge.
Different performances, I think, probably in all of those, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. And I mean, in The Two Popes and Silence of the Lambs, again, is great. But then you have The Edge performance, which is it doesn't phone it in. It's just not, it's probably not that asked about what he's doing. But also the films, I find it a bit weird. And I think that's probably one of the reasons as well I wasn't that fussed about watching, because I just kind of thought, he's not going to be asked, is he? But he was. So it was, I mean, this is leaning on Anthony Hopkins. I think we should talk about the rest of the cast briefly before we get to the scores. But he was more than asked in this film. And I think that switch when he talks about the tap dancing piece, and that switch in particular was like magnificent.
I think that bit as well, what it really got in that moment, which again, I know this from speaking to a lot of people that have gone through this, but it's when that blame suddenly goes on the person closest to you, the one that's trying to help, and they're saying all of these things to you that aren't true, and you kind of can't fight back because you don't want to make the situation worse, but then you're kind of having to take all this shit that isn't true. And I thought that exchange between him and Coleman was especially just powerful in that moment, that kind of, he suddenly turns on her, the constant reference to the younger daughter, like she's also kind of the only person trying to help, but is the kind of seen as the evil one. And actually, like, how you navigate that, because it's so isolating for both parties, like the person going through it because your world's just disappearing before you, but then also the person that's being the carer, because you're, the person you care about is disappearing before you, and any kind of relationship you've had disappearing before you, but then on top of that, you're getting all the blame. So I think that's what I did really well, that kind of, the characters were both multidimensional. It wasn't just sort of one-sided, but without being like dramatic or this is so bad, like nothing really hugely dramatic happened. And I think it was in that kind of, just the kind of, it was kind of normal, that, but then kind of absurd and obscure and strange, but they weren't like, you know, big dramatic scenes as such. It was more the emotion that was dramatic.
It sort of plays like a, almost like a psychological thriller though, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
In that you know that something isn't right, but you don't really know what it is. Obviously, you know what it is because you know that the character has dementia, but in that way, that if it had been a psychological thriller, like almost like this guy is being gaslit or whatever, like it's really interesting.
And there's also this thing of like, you just get on with it. If that happens to you, you just get on with it. You just deal with it, you know? And I think that is powerful. And to see that represented, I think, is important.
The thing with the watch is just so specific, because it's such a common thing that happens, is the sense of something's been moved or something's been lost, and the belief that someone has taken it is so strong, but we know that he's just lost it, he's just mistaken it. Just kind of like seeing that and those very small things that should you play along, should you play into it, or should you say no, actually no, that hasn't happened, and you get various sort of stages in that. And I think that it's just really kind of like grounded, like my grandma that had dementia, and that just kind of came back to where things are, like, oh, you've moved them. It's like, well, we haven't moved them. It's like, well, they're there. It's just really, just feels really like real.
I think one of the real conversations that were had between the characters were between the two people that played and husband or partner. And those conversations have happened about, we should put him in a care home, we should put him in this, and no, it's my father. That leads to tension, like mega tension between a couple or a family at the time who's kind of wrestling with that. And I've never seen that kind of played out on film before. I was really kind of impressed, but also disheartened by it. I'd hate to be the husband. I'd hate to be the partner that says you need to put your mum or your dad or someone in the care home. And it's almost like a selfish piece, but it's also a mission that we can't cope on. It's an admission that something's wrong here and we're not the people to deal with it. But also it almost seems like you're uncaring at the same time. And it's a really complex conversation that too many people have to go through. And yeah, again, just that side of it was like head in hand, like, no, I don't want to see this anymore. Mm. But yeah, is there anything else guys want to say before we head to the scores?
Just don't think it needed that music.
What was the music? I didn't notice.
And I know, who was it? Ludovico Einaudi. And I know, like, he's obviously excellent and makes exceptional scores. I just felt, if I was watching that on stage live and that was the music, I'd be up for it. I thought it would be amazing. But I just felt in this, at times, that was the only thing that aired a little bit on sort of hamming up the emotion. Or I just felt it could have been a bit more still, everything around it. Yeah. For me personally, that was the only thing that I found a little bit sort of melodramatic in places where it didn't need to be, where I thought it was powerful enough without it.
I didn't notice the music that much, so.
I generally hate that when a film tries too hard to kind of like evoke something.
Yeah, it's weird because it wasn't trying to evoke because it was already there, but there were moments where I really noticed it because I always notice music in things. Mm. And there was just a couple of points where I thought, you didn't need that. It could have just been a bit more settled because it's so chaotic anyway, the feeling without that. I don't know. That was the only thing for me that I wasn't totally sold on.
Do you know what I mean? It's like the way American documentaries work where they put like, they put this bed of like infuriating crucial music over everything, like
everything.
And it always feels like it's going to like a break, an advert break.
Yeah,
and you're like, what? And you're just like, we don't need it. Like we're you know, it's a bit condescending in a way. Like you can't manage to figure out what your emotion should be without
it's like
it.
A laughter track.
Yeah, exactly.
Laugh now.
Whereas if I'd heard that live with the score and seen it on stage, I think you would have had a visceral response to music of that quality. So it would have really done something different. But yeah, it's minor. I'm not saying I hated the music. I'm just saying for me, could have pulled back a bit. But who cares? Probably no one else.
Well, guys, let's head to the scores.
Hello, I'm Kate Lever, host of Who's a Good Dog, the podcast for anyone who's ever loved a dog. We're one of the other podcasts in the Stripped Media family. Each episode, I ask a brilliant person to introduce me to their dog and tell me how having a dog has changed their life. Listen to Who's a Good Dog wherever you get your podcasts.
So welcome to the FlixWatcher scores. They are out of 5. You may have decimal places if you wish. And we will start with you, please, Hannah, with your recommendability.
I'd say a 5, to be honest, to recommend, because I do think it's something that everyone should watch in order to gain an understanding of this disease.
Jen?
I'd have to agree with that, a 5, because it's the performances, they're so good. Like, I would recommend something on the strength of the performances alone. So, yeah, absolutely, I'd agree with that. I think a 5 is reasonable.
Helen?
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 5 as well. It's so rare that you get dramas that are, like, this good with kind of story, acting, subject matter. It's a drama, but it's not overly dramatic and everything feels very personal, and it is a tough watch, but it's such a powerful film that I just think more people should see it.
I'm going to go 4.75 and taking that 0.25 off because I think you probably have to prime people a bit and say, look, it's not going to be an easy ride, but it will be rewarding. So 4.75, repeat viewing score.
Don't know.
Well, yeah, this is where it falls down, right?
Hate yourself. No. I don't know. Do you know what? Actually, when I was thinking about doing this chat, and I was thinking about it, I was like, I probably would watch it again, but with a more critical, not to like critique it, but just to kind of start to dissect it a little bit more, like why it worked as well as it did. But then I was like, I haven't got time for that. So I wouldn't watch it again for pleasure. I don't know if I watched it the first time for pleasure. I watched it because I had to watch it with you guys. But
yeah, but you chose it.
Yeah.
Kind of.
I'm going to say like 2.7, unless you're doing like a film degree, and then probably 4.
I think it's an interesting case of, I'll talk about it in my section when I get to choose the repeat viewing score. Jen.
2 point whatever is way too high. I will never watch this film again, I don't think. Like I'm glad I watched it, but I don't think I'm going to go back.
Let's take this back a step, because you didn't watch it this time round.
No.
Is that a combination of you were too busy, but also...
I would have watched it this time round.
Okay, sure.
Out of necessity, but I didn't. And that was more due to being the single mum of a 2-year-old with a more than full-time job and a book to promote. I had intended to watch it, but Yeah. But no, I don't think beyond this, I don't think I would choose to watch it again. If it was on the telly, I might watch it, but I don't think I would be like, right, I'm going to go and sit down and actively pursue it. So I guess I'd give it like a one. If it was on the telly, I wouldn't like shy away from it, but I wouldn't, yeah.
Helen.
So am I the only one who's seen it twice then?
Yeah.
I don't think you need to see it twice. I saw it at the start of this year and I was like, it's only an hour 37. I can do that again. And I was kind of like, well, I'll just watch it again just because it has been a while since I've seen it. And I don't know what I got from it the second time round that I didn't kind of get the first time round. So 1.5.
I'm going to go a bit higher than you guys. 1.5, you say. I'm going to go for a 2. And that's because I would watch it again, not anytime soon, but I will because I want to kind of see where I'd probably be paying attention to the technicality of it and where the seams change and where the seams are. Because I think about the piano and you see that in the first two scenes, but then they're wildly different, those scenes. And you think, and it's also in the same position in that flat, in that what would be that flat, whether it's his flat or Anne's flat. And I'm like, was it the same place? Where are we at this point? And it's just things like that. That's how I'd digest it when I watch it next.
Yeah, I agree.
But what's it for that kind of position, that kind of insight? Small screen score, Hannah.
Well, I watched on my laptop.
Mm.
And again, it's like, so it is kind of a telly film. So 4.
Fair play. Jen?
Yeah, I also watched it on my laptop and I don't think that it in any way detracted from the viewing experience. So yeah, I'd say 4.
Helen?
So saw it in the cinema the first time on regular size TV the second time. I mean, other than do support your local cinema and go and see films that aren't big blockbusters, there's, you know, it's fine, perfect for TV viewing. I don't think it really changed that much other than the joy of cinemas. A 5.
Yeah, let's go for 5. I think I've seen Still Alice, for example, in the cinema, which depicts dementia or in that kind of trajectory. And I think that left the four walls of a flat, for example. But still, I think that would work very well on small screen. I think this does work very well on small screen. I don't think it's as stagey as some stage plays can films, but I think it does a great job on the small screen. Engagement score, Hannah?
I'll go 4.75.
No worries, no explanation? Just feel that's it.
That's it.
Jen?
I think I'll go 5 because I think when you're in it, you're really, really in it. It really is quite gripping. And I also think that's partly to do with the time of it. It is mercifully brief. And I also think more films should be an hour and a half. A lot of films can't carry being longer than an hour and a half. And I'd like to see more 90-minute films, please. Thanks.
Helen?
I mean, that's something I can 100% get behind. Yeah, I'm going to go 5 as well. Just completely absorbing, really absorbing. And yeah, like if you're not paying attention, then like, how are you going to know? You're going to be even more disorientated by it. So you have to give it your attention. And like, the performances are great. You can't tear your eyes off it.
Yeah, I'm going to go for 5 as well. Once you get it started, well, you have to be in the mood to watch it, I think. But once it started, you'll be missing lots of stuff if you're not paying attention. And it's not difficult to pay attention. So that gives us an overall score of 3.96875. Great. Yeah, decent. It's the repeat viewing score that let it down in inverted commas. But I think that's wholly fair in this case. So thank you very much, Hannah, for bringing the father to us. Everyone who's listening right now, do follow us on Twitter. We are at FlixWatcherPod. And of course, as well as just following us to find out what we're chatting about on the films and Netflix in general, we do put a shout out asking you guys to comment and review on the film and look for a tweet like this. We're reviewing The Father with Inspiregen and Walker_Brown. Have you seen it? Tell us your thoughts and the score out of 5 stars from the on-air shout out. And regular contributor, Lee Thomas at Lee Thomas 5 says, film of the year for me. One of those great movies I'll probably never watch again. It just hits too close to home. 5 stars. And that really emulates what we said.
It's a nutshell, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. And we've taken 45 minutes to get there.
Yeah. He's just saying like, in a tweet.
Yeah. Let's follow Lee Thomas guys as well. Not instead of, as well as. Hannah and Jen, can you sign off by telling everyone where we can find you guys online? Remind them of your books and say sayonara, goodbye, ciao, adios, arrivederci, whatever you want to say to the listeners.
Yes, I'm on Twitter, which is my full name, Hannah Walker Brown. Or we're also on Twitter, Broccoli Productions. Google both of us, you'll find our websites. My book is called A Delicate Game, Brain Injury, Sport and Sacrifice, and can be found Waterstones, independent booksellers, Amazon, if you're that way inclined.
Jen?
Yeah, I am on Twitter where I am at InspiraJen. It's an Olympics-based pun, just FYI. And also Instagram where I am Jen with 2 N's because 1 N was gone off. So JENNOFF. And my book is called The Year of the Robin, Watching It All Go Wrong for Charlton Athletic and the World, and is available from all good bookshops and online, the same places Hannah's mentioned, basically.
So go buy one book and then buy the other at the same time.
Buy
put it in the same
both
basket.
At the same time. Have a football feast time for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Both sports-based from a different angle, not just talking about scoring goals or, you know, crossing finishing lines, you know. Guys, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I'm really glad I watched it. That's a way to say it. Thank you very much for bringing that.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K, Wood Audio. Tell him FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.